All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And hello and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry and I get to be your host today. We've got kind of a conglomeration of programs. We're going to have a couple of interviews and then we've got Dr. Rebecca Grant is going to be on in the second half of the program, getting us all updated on what's going on around the world as far as American foreign policy. And she's going to be talking mostly about President Truman and his decision to drop the atomic bombs on Japan in August of 1945. But first, I want to make sure that we thank all of our sponsors here, and that would start off with Legal Help for Veterans, Eisenhower Center's After the Impact Program, the Veteran Business Outreach Center, better known as VBOC. We want to thank the National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC. For more information about all of these organizations, you can go to our website and you can see them up there. Before I forget about it, we want to make sure we thank our local veteran service organizations, and that would be the American Legion Post 46 of Ann Arbor, VFW Post 423 of Ann Arbor, and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Post 310. And as I mentioned, for more information about all of our sponsors, you can go to our website, and their links are on there. We're starting off the program with an interview that my partner Jim Falsone did with a gentleman, Jeff Kopack, from Aldi's North America Corporation here in the Southeast Michigan. And they're going to be talking about what it was like to join and what the benefits of being a member of the National Veterans Business Development Council, or NVBDC. So here's Jim with his interview.
We want to welcome you to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone, your host for a spotlight on National Veteran Business Development Council's certified companies. Veterans Radio America has a partnership with NVBDC.org. NVBDC is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses of all sizes and the corporations wanting to engage them. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio specifically today Jeff Kopack, who's the president of Aldi's National North America, which is an NVBDC certified automotive packaging company. Jeff, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Jim. Glad to be here.
Well, I know you do more than automotive packaging. I'm going to let you explain that in a minute. But let's give a little background here so folks understand. You're an Army veteran. Give us the thumbnail of your Army experience.
Let's see. Very quickly, I joined September 12, 2001, right after 9/11. I was in for 14 years. I did 6 combat tours to Iraq and Afghanistan. Got medically retired after that. I was an infantryman and then an Apache pilot. And in 14 years, they told me I was out. So. Wasn't expecting that.
Well, surprise, surprise. So much goes for the career. But we'll come back to that in a little bit. Jeff's being a little modest. In addition to his service in transitioning from infantry platoon sergeant to combat aviator and pilot, and ultimately an air mission commander, along the way he was awarded 2 Bronze Stars as well as leadership awards for his role there in the Army. After medical discharge, you came back to the Detroit, Michigan area and got involved with the family business. Tell us a little bit about what Aldi's North America does.
Well, Aldi's North America is a 100% service disabled veteran-owned business. We're 75%, I would say, into the automotive industry. We're very big in production line services, inventory management and distribution. For example, MRO crib management, custom packaging solutions and design, and we specialize in production build-ahead programs. We're in 7 states, have about 400 employees.
And the other 25%?
The other 25% goes over a range of anything from aerospace to, tons of different things.
Well, and it's, I think, important for folks to know that this is a family business, and it was started, I think, back in 1998. Is that right, Jeff?
Well, that was the original, and then I branched off and started my own business 6 years ago.
And so
there were two.
So is the LDS North America 100% owned by you, or is it?
Yeah.
Okay. And as you went about building your own business, tell us what you were thinking about in terms of how to keep moving forward.
Well, like I said, I didn't plan on doing this, but I met up with quite a few people, and I had to figure out what I was going to do. So I did my five steps of doing your research, writing a business plan, finding my funding, set up my business, and just doing what I, you know, love and know. And it moved from there.
And along the way, as you started to meet customer needs and find out what customers wanted, what were they asking you about your veteran experiences and status?
Well, they would ask, as a veteran-owned business, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that. I didn't even realize. They'd be like, are you certified? And I'd say, yeah, I'm certified. You know, you can go online originally and do your certification, not NVBDC certified. This is in the very beginning. Well, then you find out that anybody can pretty much do that, and it's not a real legit third-party certification. So I met up with Keith King, and he explained everything to me, and I thought it sounded like a great idea because I think that actual veterans that are deserving of this program should be doing this. And it's certified, and it's legit, and the corporations, that's what they're looking for.
Well, and it really has, you've seen it over 6 years, it really has changed what the customer is looking for, not just your word, hey, I served, but somebody else who's really vetted you as a company and said, yeah, there's service here, but more importantly, the veterans involved in ownership and management of the company. Isn't that what the customer's looking for?
Exactly. They're looking for that the veteran-owned company is, you know, that the vet is operational in the company, actually owns the company. It's a process to get certified, and it's a process that's well worth it. I mean, there's no stone left unturned. It definitely sets apart the people who deserve it. And the people who put in the hard work and actually are trying to get certified from others that maybe are just doing a different type of certification online or what have you.
Yeah, back in you know, a decade ago or more, it was sort of just a self-certification, and it has evolved over time. And I think as customers began saying, well, we want to help veterans, but we want to make sure that it's really a veteran-owned business, it looked to how it was working with groups like African Americans, Native Americans, women, and realize there really was a vetting process that should be created, and that's the void that National Veteran Business Development Council kind of filled in. You mentioned Keith King as its founder, but that's kind of what it did. It filled in that void that was missing, didn't it?
Oh, definitely. 100%.
Tell us how long it took you to go through this, because I know it's not easy.
I wouldn't say it's not easy. It's just you have to be prepared. And it's all laid out on what you need, all the documentation. And, you know, the documentation is not just you turning it in. It's the NVBDC receiving it from the government. So it's real documentation. It took a couple of months. I really don't remember. It was about 6 years ago. But it took a little bit of time, but it was well worth it. And just like anything else, if you're prepared and you do your homework, you're ready for the certification.
Well, that sounds like an Army pilot. If you're prepared and do your work, you'll get through this.
Exactly.
As you went through this, were other businesses you were talking to, other competitors or colleagues saying, do it or don't do it? What was the encouragement level? Maybe it was from the customers.
It was. I didn't realize until I brought it up to a few of the potential customers that when they heard NVBDC, their eyes just opened. Oh, NVBDC. Well, I knew that it was onto something right there. When you would just say veteran-owned prior to that, and they were like, oh, okay. We have 1,000 of those. NVBDC certified, it seemed like it put you in a different category of a legit certified company.
Yeah, and that third-party certification for all the big companies, all the Fortune 500 and others, that's what really makes the difference, is that third-party certification. But can you tell us about what value you think that NVBDC certification has brought to your company?
Well, I can tell you right off the bat, larger customers are just looking for that. And as soon as you say you have it, well, let me go back real quick. Just saying you have it doesn't really do anything for you. Like I said, you have to have a plan. You have to, you know what you're doing and be good at what you do. It doesn't mean you just walk in and get business somewhere because you're certified. But, you know, the diversity and inclusion for the procurement practices and the policies of the corporations that are out there looking for it, as soon as you're in that category and they see your certification, I'd say 9 out of 10 times, you at least get the opportunity to quote on business or bid on business.
And, Jeff, did you see business opportunities that you looked at and said, well, that's just because I've got the NVBDC certification?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that you have to show your value as the company. And, oh, by the way, I also happen to be NVBDC certified. First, you sell yourself and the company and then explain what certifications you have.
Absolutely. Well, you've obviously done well in these initial 6 years. There's certainly been some economic hurdles as we're going through now in this country. So every little edge, and not only doing quality work, but every other edge kind of helps, doesn't it?
It definitely helps.
If there's somebody out there
who want to do business with certified NVBDC certified companies, they want to do business. I mean, the diversity and the spend out there looking for these businesses, I mean, it's outstanding. And they know the quality they're getting when they see that certification. They know that not only are you certified, but you have that whole network behind you at the NVBDC to help. Well, any questions you have, I mean, they're just there for...
Well, let me ask, if there's a business owner out there thinking about this, what would be your recommendation on looking into NVBDC?
I would say if you are a veteran, you need to be NVBDC certified. I mean, it's just the opportunities are endless. And as long as you have a solid foundation and a good business and good values, is all it can do is just take you up to the next level.
Well, we want to
give you opportunities that may have not even have been there that you didn't even know were there.
Absolutely, and we want to encourage others to go to nvbdc.org to check it out.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim. I thought that was great. I really encourage all of you business owners out there to get in touch with the NVBDC. That's their website. You can go to nvbdc.org for more information. Right now, we're going to go right into our second interview, and this is with Hope Seck, and Hope is the managing editor for a program for the news programs on military.com, and I'll let her explain what military.com is. So here we go straight into this interview. This is Hope Seck. This morning on Veterans Radio, we're talking with Hope Hodge-Seck, and she is a managing editor for military.com. And Hope, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, what is military.com? Tell me what they do.
So military.com, we're an independent news site covering the military community. In fact, we are the most popular online news source, and we've been steadily increasing in popularity over the last 3-plus years. And we have more than that, too. So we've got a front page that's full of all the news, covering all the services and elements of the military. But we also have newsletters and pay and benefits calculators and a history section and military entertainment. So we really try to be sort of your one-stop location for, you know, if you have a reason to care about the military, this is really the first and the only place you should need to go to be fully informed.
This is the only place to go. I was looking at your front page this morning. We're doing this interview on Monday, August 10th. And the headline is that you have the remains of the missing Marines that were lost in that amphibious vehicle is on the front page. We've got Army cost estimates on next generation vehicle programs, DOD to assess female troops' reproductive health for the first time in decades. This is a constant thing that we keep going through when we talk to people about the VA as well. We got plan for military Medal of Honor monument in D.C. All kinds of different great stories here that I think people would be really interested in.
There's a ton of variety in the stories that we cover. So we will do updates on big acquisition programs, you know, the new vehicles and aircraft and ships, the cutting edge technology, you know, we'll cover AI and robotics and all the cool new stuff. But we also really comprehensively cover deployments and uniforms, which is always a big issue with our readers, and benefits. We've got one writer who just stays kind of up to date on all of the benefits, whether you're active duty or a veteran or a military family member. You should have it there, and the information should be useful and up to date and accessible.
Well, I may have to get a hold of that person. We do a benefits program every month.
Fantastic.
And, you know, try to keep people informed as to what's going on, what's changing, what is, you know, what's going on as far as at the VA healthcare system and also on the disability side. So I might have to talk to you about that later.
Yeah, for sure.
So tell me again how you got involved in writing for military.
So it's really funny. I grew up in Boston and went to school in New York City, and my first job out of college was in Jacksonville, North Carolina, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners know is home to Camp Lejeune, the biggest Marine Corps base on the East Coast. So, you know, I really kind of came from being sort of an insular Northeasterner who didn't know much about the military to all of a sudden writing about the military for the local newspaper. And it was very fulfilling to learn to speak the language and know what the acronyms meant. And my neighbors and friends were all young Marines and Marine spouses and family members. And, you know, if you've ever lived in a military community like that, you know, just how much it draws you in and how much you quickly feel a part of it and feel connected to it. So that's my story. I spent a couple of years there, and then I moved to the D.C. area with my now husband, and I spent a few years writing for Marine Corps Times, which is part of sort of the Military Times conglomerate, and I moved over to military.com. My background is writing for the Marine Corps and the Navy and Coast Guard, but I really enjoy my role now sort of covering all the services.
Well, we're talking with Hope Hodge-Seck here. She's the managing editor for news at military.com. And in their press kit, you sent me a bunch of other different reporters' bios. And I was interested in some of these people. Do they work directly for military.com, or are they kind of contributors? I'm looking at Matthew Cox right now. It says defense reporter.
That's right. So Matt is one of the longest, I guess the most senior writers at military.com. He's actually a former, Army veteran from the Gulf War era. And, he's been here for, I believe, 10 years. So yes, everyone on there, they work full time for military.com. A lot of the reporters have a lot of seniority. Somebody who's not on that press kit, who is, you know, one of our standby writers, is Richard Sisk, who's actually an infantryman, an infantry officer for the Marine Corps in Vietnam. And, he's been reporting for, you know, more than 30 years and much of that with military.com.
Wow. I think everybody should be really excited with the idea of looking at what military.com has got to offer. There are stories I'm looking here. We've got people that specialize in the Marine Corps. We've got air warfare and missile defense. We've got Director of Operations and Strategic Partnership. That'd be Sarah Blansett. Many of them are veterans or married to veterans. And as you mentioned, you kind of got indoctrinated, it sounds like, by living down in Camp Lejeune.
In the best way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what my wife ended up doing when I was at Fort Rucker years and years ago. Is, you know, you kind of get all wrapped up in this military family, and it turns out that most people really do care about what is going on, and I think it looks like the idea of military.com is something that is great. It also looks like you have stories or probably editors for each of the different branches. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So we've got Oriana Pollack is our air warfare writer. So she writes mostly about the Air Force, but also about other aviation programs. Gina Harkins writes about the Marine Corps and the Navy and sometimes the Coast Guard. We call it the Sea Services Beat. Matt, who you mentioned, covers ground combat and specifically the Army. Patricia Keim, who I think is also not on there, she's a new addition, but she covers all military and veterans health issues, which is so crucially important, and covers Congress for us as well. So we really believe in having each writer really own sort of their chunk of territory, their beat, and just know it so deeply and, you know, stay really well connected to all the movers and shakers and decision makers in that area. And so I think they do that really extraordinarily well.
I wanted to ask you, as early on as far as reading your bio, that you were embedded in Afghanistan with the Marines. Can you tell me a little bit about that? That must have been pretty interesting.
Sure, yeah. So the first time I was there was in 2014. And it was just as the Marine Corps was pulling out most troops as the drawdown to the end of Operation Enduring Freedom was happening. So I was able to be there on the ground as the Marines were pulling out of Sangin. And at the time, of course, they had this amazing story of how it went from this really violent area, the scene of so many really intense, legendary Marine Corps battles, to being a fairly stable, peaceful place. And, you know, a few years down the road, things have changed and troops have gone back in. And, you know, it was not sort of the complete, conclusive mission end that we would have hoped. But, you know, I spent a lot of time down at Camp Leatherneck and Camp Bastion, and spent time out at some of the FOBs and really got to know, what it was like on the ground, for these troops being deployed. And some really amazing stories came out of that. So since then, I've been back to Afghanistan once, traveling with the Commandant of the Marine Corps in 2017. I also went to Iraq on that trip. And it's so important to go to bases and go down range and spend time with troops in that environment. In fact, we've got reporters going on two trips, you know, despite the COVID environment just this week. So, I think that's something that it's really important, an important investment for our readers.
I think so, too. And I mean, especially it gives you credibility when you're writing their stories that you've actually been there. And, you can relate to not only what, in your case, the Marines are doing, but you probably, you can describe the conditions there, the wonderful weather that these men and women have to, attempt to survive in. these are things that people, I think civilians just don't understand. And I think it from what I've read of your writings, you do an excellent job of bringing us right into what's happening. So I wanted to commend you on your ability to do that.
Well, thank you so much. As you know, it's just about trying to do justice to these stories and, to the sacrifices of the men and women who are out there protecting our freedom.
Well, the other thing I like about military.com, and as much as I've been reading it, is that there is really no political viewpoint, I guess you could say. I mean, it appears that you're trying to do the same thing that we do here on Veterans Radio, and that is to stay as apolitical as possible and just give the facts and let our audiences decide.
That's very much our approach. You know, we get a lot of critical feedback from our readers who think that we're too far over to one side or the other, and, you know, that's fine. They can think what they think and send us their feedback. But we really want to serve all all members of the military community, and that does represent a wide range of political viewpoints. So we try to shoot straight down the middle, you know, give people the facts and let them decide, you know, what they mean and how they should be interpreted.
Well, I think that's important for all news agencies to do. We wish that could happen all across the board. But so what do you see of, you know, military.com becoming in the next couple of years? What are the future plans for your organization?
Well, one of the things I'm most excited about with military.com is that we're constantly changing, constantly evolving, constantly developing new products and ways to serve our readers and our audience. Two that I'll mention that are just emerging. We have all of these amazing free newsletters that you can go to the site right now and sign up for. For example, you know, if you're an active duty member of the Army or the Navy, you can get your Army or Navy weekly newsletter with the headlines that you need. And if you're, say, an Army or Coast Guard veteran, you can go ahead and get your Veterans Insider specific to that service. So we've got those and then a bunch of other newsletter products as well. But we just launched one that is purely sort of kind of entertainment, more, you know, whether it's new movies in the theater that have to do with the military or just sort of more fun, lighthearted stories. You can find those all in a new weekly newsletter called At Ease. So I'm really enjoying that. And then we just launched a podcast that's I actually hosted by myself. It's called Left of Boom. You can find it, you know, on the website or wherever you get your podcasts. And I'm having such a great time interviewing the most interesting people from all around the military that I've encountered in my career. So we're going to continue to develop things like that. And we hear from our readers all the time about what they like, what they don't like, you know, what would be useful to them. Mm-hmm. So I think you can continue to expect just sort of new innovations to reach people better with the info that they need.
I agree. I think you probably do a great job with your podcasting. I've got to go back in there and start listening to some of those myself. I also noticed that you've got some videos that are available for people to watch, and other types of stories. And I guess the one thing I wanted to make sure is that this is all free.
It is all free. You know, a lot of news outlets, including some that I've worked for in the past, have put up paywalls and different things like that. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I think journalism is really struggling to figure out how to stay profitable, you know, right, and still deal with the challenges of being online. But it's been really important to us to keep our content free, you know, to not gate off things that are useful to our audience. So yep, you know, access as much as you want of it every day. It's all there.
And that's all there, right there at military.com. And we've been talking with Hope Hodsek today. She's the managing editor for military.com. And I want to thank you, Hope, so much for your time. And I encourage our audiences, both of our audiences, to go to military.com and check it out. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Hope, for that interview. It was, I thought, very interesting. And we're going to be working with military.com in the future, hopefully, with they're going to be sending us news stories, and many of their editors are going to be hopefully going to be contributing more and more to Veterans Radio. We're going to have our, what I consider our special guest, a longtime contributor to Veterans Radio, and that is Dr. Rebecca Grant. So stay tuned, and we will be right back with that interview. All right, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're with one of our favorite contributors today. That's Dr. Rebecca Grant. Dr. Grant is a national security analyst based out of Washington, D.C. She earned her Ph.D. in international relations from the London School of Economics at the age of 25. Smart woman. Then worked for RAND and on the staff of the Secretary of the Air Force and Chief of Staff of the Air Force. Since founding IRIS Independent Research, she has specialized in research for government and aerospace industry clients. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Grant has been a frequent contributor to Veterans Radio, and we want to welcome her to the program today. Good morning, Dr. Grant.
Dale, how are you? Good to be with you again.
I'm fine. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm really excited to talk with you today. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, because earlier in the week was the anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you had written an article about that, which got my attention. So could we talk about that right here at the beginning?
Yes, it's such a historic, very solemn anniversary of the 75 years ago when B-29 bomber dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima on August 6th, and then another B-29 called Boxcar followed up with a bomb dropped on the city of Nagasaki on August 9th. And Dale, as you remember and all your listeners know, it was those two atomic bombs that compelled the Emperor of Japan to override his very warlike military staff and agree to unconditional surrender to all the Allies, bringing an end to World War II.
Right, and this was a really hard decision that was left up to President Truman, who had only been in office a couple of months.
Right, Truman had taken over after the death of Franklin Roosevelt back in April of 1945, and you look back on him and you think, boy, Truman didn't have long in the job before he had to make that big decision. But what I found in my research and enjoyed writing about him was that Truman was really uniquely qualified to make this momentous decision. And the reason why goes back to his own youth. Truman served in World War I. He was not a young man when he did it. He was about 34 years old. He'd been in the National Guard for 10 years, which is something that that bright young men did back in his day. And Truman was an artillery officer. And in 1918, he went to France along with lots of other American doughboys. He learned how to fire. It was a 75-millimeter gun, so a pretty big gun for sure. And by the summer of 1918, the U.S. forces there were preparing to mount their own operations. For the previous year, America had been in the war since 1917, but mainly serving as an augmentation to the French and some of the British lines. But by 1918, the plan was for America to wage some of its own campaigns, and Truman played a pretty big part in those, especially in the very biggest American offensive of World War I, which was called the Meuse-Argonne Offensive. And Dale, we forget about it now, but there were over a million U.S. soldiers involved in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, 26,000 deaths, and over 100,000 casualties in that offensive, which took place in late September of 1918 and went on for a few weeks. So what about Captain Truman? Well, by this point, the captain was in charge of Battery D, which he described as a very rough group of Germans and Irish Catholic men from the Kansas City area. As you remember, this was a time when regiments and military units were drawn up from local areas, particularly in the Guard, which was what Truman was in. So he was terrified about taking over this group. Now picture Harry Truman. He wears glasses. You know, he's not the tallest fellow. But it worked out really well. They really liked Truman as their captain. So when the Meuse-Argonne offensive began, Truman's Battery D fired 3,000 rounds of this 75-millimeter ammunition in 4 hours in the opening barrage.
Wow.
And he went on then, I know it's incredible, right, to think of the, you know, the horses and the guns and the men rucking the ammunition up in the dark there in France and getting ready to step off, you know, into no man's land. So, you know, Truman really saw the horrors of war up close. And I don't know, Dale, if you had any relatives that were in World War I, anyone from your family?
No, I think they were all too old or just too young. They ended up in World War II.
Yeah, so I had some great uncles who served in the Great War, and boy, they were a stern, not very talkative group of men, you know, even as very elderly gentlemen. But, you know, Truman really saw what this offensive was like. And, of course, in the fall of 1918, the war ended in November of 1918, but Truman didn't know that was coming. he and others were getting ready for a major offensive that would take place in the spring of 1919 and wipe Germany's army off the face of the earth, all this. So, you know, Truman was very unique in his experiences, and in fact, he was the only one of our presidents in the 20th century who saw sustained ground combat. And you're thinking, well, what about Eisenhower? Obviously famous Allied commander in World War II, but Eisenhower had spent World War I running training camps in the U.S. So he really, Eisenhower had actually no experience of ground combat. And of course there was John Kennedy, who served in the Navy, when we think of the story of PT-109. Richard Nixon was a Navy officer stationed oddly on an Air Force base down in the Southwest Pacific. But Truman was unique in seeing what war was really about. And fast forward now to this decision in 1945, and you know, I think Truman really looked back to his own experiences and thought, we don't want the needless slaughter that an invasion of Japan would entail. And so for him, it was he took his time to think about the bomb as the test progressed, but all his science advisors and I think his own understanding recommended that if there was a way to stop this war short of an invasion of Japan, Harry Truman was going to do it. And he made that decision with a strong, clear conscience and never second-guessed himself on the dropping of the A-bombs to end World War II.
Well, right. And in reading your article, you go into a little bit more detail about that. And we're going to have a link to that article on our webpage. But I think, as you mentioned, the important thing is about Truman's own experience. I mean, there were guesstimates of, you know, millions of American casualties. The Japanese had a no-surrender mentality, just by the examples of Iwo Jima and Okinawa. And I think, obviously, we all, in hindsight, would agree with what Truman did. And as the other thing that is pointed out is that there hasn't ever been another one dropped in anger since.
Yes, and so Truman's decision ended World War II, and it also established nuclear deterrence, which has been a bedrock policy for every president since. It was for Truman, and it's been a president's policy ever since then. Every president we've had has supported nuclear deterrence. We credit nuclear deterrence with keeping the U.S. and the West apart from a full-out war with the Soviet Union. You know, that policy of deterrence has become essential to great power management, and it is today. And like you, Dale, I was struck with not only Truman looking back at his World War I experience, but he had the full set of plans and decisions for that invasion of Japan. It was going to be called Operation Downfall. The first piece was Operation Olympic, which was to invade the southern tip of Japan in November of 1945, and they'd follow up with another invasion in the spring of 1946. And as you said, the casualty estimates, both for the U.S. forces and, of course, among Japanese military and civilians, were thought to be very, very, very high. It would have been an extremely bloody event. And I think Truman, having had to make some of the preliminary decisions to get the planning in order for that invasion, was very well aware that the A-bombs were what had the chance to prevent that invasion and bring the war to an end.
I think also what's interesting is nobody knew that we didn't have any more.
Right. It was the supreme bluff. In fact, the bomb dropped on Hiroshima was a little different from the one dropped on Nagasaki, and there were only the two available at that time. But Truman wanted to give the impression that this destruction could be meted out again and again if necessary. And, of course, they built up the arsenal, thereby bringing about nuclear deterrence. It certainly worked, and I think it's important to situate ourselves in that time frame of the summer of 1945. And no question, it's something that was solemn, tragic in many ways, but prevented something much worse and has certainly added to security for the U.S. and untold millions of others over these decades.
Well, we can kind of transition from that to the, you know, safety of the United States and around the world. And there's a lot of things that are still going on 75 years later. And in fact, you mentioned that you wanted to talk a little bit today about, you know, what the Russians are up to today.
There's a lot on the boil. And Russia is like a spider involved in a whole lot of it. But let me hit a couple high points that have really developed over the summer, and one of those is Libya. Now, you don't see this
in the press very much, but Libya has been engaged in a civil war for quite a few years now, and Russia is backing the rebels in the civil war. Now, not only backing them, but Russia has a paramilitary organization called the Wagner Company that brings in mercenaries. So they bring in mercenaries. But this summer, they shifted tactics again, and Russia has actually flown in their own military equipment to Libya. And we know this because our United States Africa Command keeps a close eye on them and has put out some pretty convincing satellite photos showing things like Russian MiG fighter jets down in Libya, Russian air defense systems to defend the fighters and other things. The big Russia, you know, nobody has planes bigger than Russia, and some of their big Ilyushin combat cargo planes have been flying supplies in directly to Libya. And Africa Command puts it best. This is just a very clear escalation, and it's another attempt by Russia to grab yet another foothold in the Mediterranean region. And you think, why? Well, kind of pull back and look at a map. They've got now their two permanent bases in Syria, which happened under the Obama years. Mm-hmm. And if they now can get a permanent base in Libya, they start to block off the Mediterranean from the U.S. and NATO and start to expand their influence around there. So that is what they are trying to do. Russia is trying to gain a foothold in Libya.
As you mentioned, this is not something that's been in the news, and it's kind of an eye-opening story. And that the idea is, what are we doing about this right now?
Well, the first thing we're doing is keeping a very close eye on what Russia is up to. Libya's actual government has some UN support, but we're not engaging directly at this point. But I think keeping an eye on this and making sure that our allies, both in Europe and at the UN, are very aware of what Russia is doing, that's the number one thing at the moment. You know, Putin's strategy is classic Leninist and very hard to defeat. It's a gray area strategy. They poke and push and send in planes and do a little bit here and a little bit there. We've seen this unfold in Ukraine, where they have supported the Russian forces there with little, what they call little green men, you know, the terrorist forces that come in. We've seen that them do this with Syria, where they come in under the pretext of supporting the government of Assad and end up with some bases. And they're really doing the same thing. And it's very hard to decide at what point to push back on Russia. Going back to Syria in 2013, this was where the classic Obama administration red line was drawn, and yet they failed to take action because they were worried about Russian forces in the area. So they do it little by little, creeping, drip, 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 and that's their effort to extend influence. Lenin said, you know, first you probe with the bayonet, and if you hit steel, you pull back, but if you hit mush, you continue. And so by taking these little incremental steps, the rest of the world has a tough time deciding when do we say enough is enough. I mean, shoot, no one wants to go to war with Russia. No one wants to put U.S. forces in some of these locations. But it's very, very difficult to know, and it's hard to watch them just creep along, extending their influence and using their military forces to do it.
Well, it seems like we're getting ourselves into some difficult situations. What with the drawbacks? I mean, obviously, we're trying to get out of Afghanistan again, but now we're talking also about reducing our troop levels in Germany. What do you think about that?
Germany, that certainly did make the headlines. I'm not as concerned about that from a military strategy perspective for two reasons, the first of which is we have really added to the forces we have in Poland, right? So we have an entire brigade combat team able to operate from Poland. Some of the equipment gets flown in at the last minute if they need it. But this is a base area that's been set up over the last few years. Sometimes, you know, you'll see, if you're watching the Super Bowl or a game, you'll see a remote feed, and it's from the troops in Poland. And, you know, That is a long way further east.
Right.
So we have some additional forces there. And then with the forces in Germany, you know, I think there's a couple elements to it. One, the Trump administration has really dinged Merkel for not paying investing the full 2% of defense, of GDP into defense. So there's a little bit of politics there. The other aspect is, you know, Germany has, is constructing this huge Nord Stream 2 pipeline. It's a Russian pipeline that's to run through Germany and supply more fuel that way. And Trump administration's been upset about that because, you know, on the one hand, you've got U.S. and NATO forces in Germany. On the other hand, they're getting so much of their energy from Russia. And then finally, you know, forces are just a little different than they were decades ago. You can probably pretty easily take 12,000 forces out if you're able to fly them back in and move them around. And then, we rely now on much lighter ground forces than we have in the past, even when we're talking about deterrence of Russia in NATO. So from a military perspective, the 12,000 forces is not such a big deal. It's much, much more of a diplomatic move, and I think partly an attempt by the president to keep the lash on NATO to try to spend more and reduce U.S. spending.
Okay. What do you think is going on in Afghanistan? it seems like Russia is you know, kind of just hovering over all of these different parts of the world, and that, if we just let Afghanistan self-destruct, they'll just move back in there.
Well, Russia is certainly hovering over Afghanistan, which they have done for a long time. Some kind of good news, bad news. There is some good news. Remember, we had the peace agreement signed between the U.S. and the Taliban back in February of this year. One of the key elements of that was for the Afghan government to release a lot of Taliban prisoners and vice versa. And that didn't happen at first, but now actually it has. Again, not in the news a lot, but most of that prisoner exchange has gone forward. So that is a good sign. You know, what's much more difficult is that there are a number of competing interests in Afghanistan, and none of them wish the U.S. well. Russia is high up there. You know, we know that Russia has made arms supplies available to various insurgent groups in Afghanistan for a long time. Other problem in Afghanistan is Iran, which has a, 500-mile border there in the West and has been a source of back and forth of influence as well. And then you've got, not only do you have the Taliban who have their own factions, but there are still ISIS, and I call them ISIS Khorasan, ISIS elements within Afghanistan. Those are the ones that are doing most of the attacks on the Afghani population because they don't want to see the peace deal go through. So got some good news, bad news there. The Secretary of Defense has said that we will be trying to get down to 5,000 U.S. forces in Afghanistan towards the end of the year. Two reasons you can do that. One, they actually increased U.S. forces in Afghanistan back in 2017, so he's got some margin to continue a drawdown. The other reason is that's really an air power theater. The Afghan has its own air force now, and we have quite a bit of NATO air surveillance and air firepower in place, and that is how that war has been conducted from the beginning, oh so long ago. So taking out ground forces is, again, not, from a military perspective, not necessarily a problem, because I'll tell you who's not leaving, and that's all the Air Force and airmen from the NATO countries and the other coalition partners. No one is taking the air power out of Afghanistan just yet.
Right, and it just seems like that's the way that we fight modern wars now. You don't need as many ground pounders out there when you've got all this air support and so forth.
Certainly that's been the strategy in Afghanistan. So you need your ground forces that control air, your air controllers. You need your ground forces that help advise your local and Afghan forces. And some of those are regular army, and some of those are other types, and some are allies. And then you need ground forces providing security. But as far as mounting large ground force operations, that's never been how the strategy has been in Afghanistan. So the air piece has really been central to all of that. It's allowed us to keep our footprint relatively smaller, even back in the days when we had 100,000 NATO forces in that area. They still relied quite a bit on air power. And now that we've got the peace agreement and it really is a counterinsurgency holding operation, then we'll continue to rely on the air surveillance and, of course, the ability to bring in more air firepower or more forces if we need them. But I think the hope is that this will stabilize and be something that the Afghan army can control on the ground with help from the Afghan Air Force and, of course, the coalition partner air forces, too.
That would be a good deal. That would be a good deal for us, especially. Speaking of the Air Force, I also noticed that they have a new service chief that took over last
year. Yes.
Can you tell me about him?
General, I want to tell you about C.Q. Brown. He's a history maker. General C.Q. Brown is, well, first of all, Dale, you know, this is the Air Force, and C.Q. Brown is first and foremost a fighter pilot, okay? Mm-hmm. F-16s, he's commanded at all levels from squadron right up through having wing command twice, and he came most recently from the Pacific, where he's been in command of all Pacific Air Forces. So thinking about China and North Korea on a daily basis. Before that, he actually ran the air war in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. So he is a true blue fighter pilot all the way through. He also happens to be the first black man or African-American man to be the chief of any service ever. Mm-hmm. And I know you're thinking, wait, Colin Powell. This is true. General Colin Powell was the first African-American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Powell, of course, was a four-star Army general, went on to be Secretary of State. But remember, Powell was not Chief of Staff of the Army. So General C.Q. Brown, who took over August 6th, is Chief of Staff of the Air Force, making him the first African-American to head any branch of the military. And very interesting, he gave an interview a couple months ago, a few weeks after the incident with the killing of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And C.Q. Brown talked about his career, but also what it had been like for him as in his words, as an African-American in the Air Force. And, you know, that's the incident that really stuck out was he talked about being at the bar with his squadron, which is a very normal fighter pilot thing to do, part of the whole bonding process. He's there at the bar, and some other African-American officers that aren't in his unit come up to him and say, hey, why are you spending so much time with these fighter pilots? You know, aren't you, you're letting us down. You're not black enough. You know, and he wrote very movingly, spoke very movingly about his feeling of living in two worlds and trying to be so much better because people expected him to not be as good because of his skin color. So very interesting, perfect man qualified to lead the Air Force at this juncture. And then someone who comes with some very unique insights on achieving great success in the military and being African American.
I think it's a great great story. I was talking recently with a friend of ours here in the Ann Arbor area who is a 3-star general in the Air Force, African American, and he was talking about his experiences during the Vietnam era when he was going through flight school and had to live in Mississippi. And he couldn't find housing down there until they finally were able to find him a place on base. But just, he said, what a learning experience the whole thing was. Because he said, you know, you just have to be better than the rest. And I think that's kind of a common theme when you talk about these senior officers that have worked their way up in all of the different branches. I have to congratulate General Brown on his appointment. I think that's a great opportunity. We're running out of time already, which is really kind of sad. But I need to get to just a few words on China, but then I'm going to ask you to come back in September for more detail on them. So what is the main thing that they're up to today?
China, the level of hostility has really gone up. Of course, they are, well, just the other day, they flew one of their big bombers down around the South China Sea area. Interesting to me that it was a joint operation with the bomber, which is in their Air Force, attached to one of their Navy flying regiments, cruising around with all these weird shapes under the wings, trying to scare you into thinking this is some big hypersonic missile, which it could well be. So they're really extending their military operations. On the diplomatic front, there is a really new climate of hostility. You know, of course, about the crackdown in Hong Kong, the U.S. closing China's consulate in Houston, and then it's a prolonged battle over 5G and the networks. And, of course, China threw sanctions on 11 Americans, several of whom are U.S. senators. So in terms of diplomacy, the level of hostility is really high. You know, I think everyone now realizes that gloves are off with China. The virus came from there, and they didn't handle it well, at a minimum. And we are in a state of say low-level conflict, diplomatic and trade conflict with China, even while they remain an important part of the world economy. So this is just something we have to find our way through, and we have to continue to resist. Some good news on this front is that our ally Britain has reversed a decision and decided not to let China's big Huawei build out Britain's 5G networks. And that's a great change of pace for Britain and really reconfirms that a lot of our security going forward is going to depend on the Five Eyes, Britain, U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and other like-minded allies who are ready to resist China's penetration of our economy and military at every level. And it really is. It's everything from cyber to trade to President Trump is banning the TikTok video app starting in 45 days. And unfortunately, that is where we need to be. The threat is that diverse and really spreads all through our society. So we're in a new era with China.
That's for sure. Well, Dr. Grant, I want to thank you very much for taking the time for this interview. As I mentioned, I'm going to try and get a commitment out of you to come back in September, and really we'll go into more detail about China and what else is happening around the world. Okay.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to talk on Veterans Radio anytime, Dale. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We want to thank all of our guests here today on Veterans Radio, and we want to thank you especially for tuning in and listening. This is Dale Thronberry again for Veterans Radio. Until next week, you are dismissed.